Not because I wouldn't like to, but because I have notes and I don't have enough time to go through them. Let me begin. I'm confused. I'm perplexed. I don't quite understand what's going on. Why don't I understand what's going on? In fall of 2008, and this is obviously about UCI in the budget context. In fall 2008, in response to the plummeting stock market and the economic recession, American universities across this country were seriously challenged. In the 2008-09 academic year, Harvard, the wealthiest university not only in the United States, but in the world, froze faculty recruitments and all faculty salaries. At the same time, Stanford, another university of extreme wealth, cut all the salaries of top administrators across the board by 10%. What did UCI do? It continued to recruit 25 new faculty members. It maintained merit, that is to say, salary increases for faculty, and it froze increases for top administrators under most, but not all, circumstances. In other words, it didn't do very much. Since then, the UCI budget situation has become substantially worse. Even a casual reading of the press indicates this to be the case. And the immediate future, we are told, is fraught with great danger. About a year ago, Professor Yudof wrote, an all-cuts budget would be devastating to the university and the communities and students we serve, and put at risk our faculty's research, a critical driver of future jobs and wealth in California. Just a couple of weeks ago at the Regents meeting in the middle of May, the Vice President for Budget, Patrick Lentz, indicated the institution is now at a crossroads. Further cuts put the university at risk of permanent and irreversible decline in academic quality. And last week, the front page of the New York Times had the article which began with the title, California Cuts Threaten the Status of Universities. At the same time, what do we see on campus? We don't see very much that reflects this reality that we've heard with words. As you walk to the university club today, or drove, you pass neatly trimmed grass and trees. If you visited any of our new buildings, you would see that they are not only well maintained, but well-furnished and well-equipped. Furniture arrives that is beautiful, and if it's not satisfactory, it's replaced with still newer furniture. We are recruiting this year approximately 58 new faculty positions to the campus. And if you read our campus email communications, they are filled with programs calling for applications and providing money. Even programs that had been discontinued a couple of years ago, as, for example, the freshman seminar program, has been resurrected with new monies to feed it. I'm puzzled. I'm puzzled by this contrast between the budgetary realities, as I read about them in the speeches by the president and vice president of the university and in the newspapers, and by what I see. I don't know how to reconcile those two. So I would describe the current situation, in my opinion, as being surrealistic. Now, the iconic image of surrealism is this painting, which you may be familiar with, which was done by the artist René Magritte. It is a painting with the words below it, "This is not a pipe." So my sense of what's happening is this is not a budget crisis. Now let me try to explain or talk about or sensitize us to why do we not see the budget crisis, what's really happening, and how do we explain that. So first, let's look at some of the background at UCI. And to do that, I want to consider effectively three factors: university reserves, the strategy of our administration, and what I might call a false sense of security. During the 10-year period preceding the recession, enormous amounts of money were poured into the UC system. On the UCI campus, we were unable to spend everything that we received. In turn, the central administration built up their reserves. So did every academic and administrative unit on this campus. The same phenomena clearly took place at the system level. We were sucking money out of the legislature and out of the state government at unprecedented levels, far beyond what we could actually use, so we hived it away. In turn, as the budget crisis struck, we had quite a bit of saved monies to help us deal with the problems. And I think that's the first reason why we don't see this. Remind you, all of you have been around a while. In the early 1990s, we had a budgetary crisis. You could see the university in disrepair. Grounds were not kept clean. Trees and bushes were overgrown. The social science tower had pieces of stucco that were falling out of the side of the building, and they put up nets to catch it so that we weren't going to kill our students. We didn't have the money to fix the building. Early 1990s. Now it's much worse, and everything looks great. Absolutely fantastic. One reason is the reserves. Second reason is administrative strategy. The administration has chosen to delay to the maximum the implementation of serious budget reductions. Now, the office of the president, for example, at the outset, imposed an 8% furlough on faculty, which was something that people complained about substantially, were very, very upset about. It helped the university fit into the larger crisis of the state of California. Interestingly enough, the data on the Irvine campus revealed that of the faculty who were subjected to the 8% furlough, three-quarters had no reduction in their income. That was done through a combination of two distinct factors. I believe the actual number is 73%. On the one hand, there were those faculty members who had various forms of extramural support, which they could use and migrate over to their salary so their income stayed the same. And for those who didn't, the central administration put together a special pot of money to help feed those who were being underfed, leading to the fact that approximately three-quarters had no furlough, even though if you listen to the chorus of complaints, you would think that faculty were scrounging on the grounds of Aldrich Park, hunting for walnuts and berries so that they could ward off imminent starvation. Mind you, the Office of the President indicated that was a one-time event because it was so catastrophic. Now, the administration decided not to emphasize also the existing budgetary problems. There are a number of distinct reasons which might have led to this decision. The most positive of these, I think, would be that the faculty and staff should be spared from the additional worry about the university's money problems for as long as possible. This was the challenge for the administration to face, and the faculty should not be distracted from the important efforts in the classroom and on their research. Those factors were critically important for why the campus has not talked about, mobilized about, collectively worried about the budgetary problems. Now, there has also been, in my opinion, a somewhat seductive but false idea that if the state does not fund the UC system at the level that it needs to be funded, then necessary funds will be obtained through increased tuition and an increased number of out-of-state and foreign students. In other words, there's really nothing to worry about. All money is green. If the state doesn't give it to us, the students will give it to us because we are such a great bargain. And everything's going to be fine, so why There's no need for draconian adjustments. Everything's going to be hunky-dory. Those, I think, are the core reasons why this budgetary situation that we might read about every day, we don't feel on a daily basis. Now, what happened? The second issue to address is what happened at UCI as a background to the current crisis. What happened during the last phase of growth? As all of you know, the UC system is a system that historically has spurts of growth followed by consolidation. We get tremendous amounts of money poured in, the system makes a major advance, we consolidate, and then after a certain amount of time, more money comes in. So, for example, we had such a very large spurt of growth during the mid and late 1980s, which we consolidated during the 1990s. Then we had another spurt of growth beginning in the late 1990s through the first half dozen years or so of the new millennium. What happened? Objectively, from the late 1990s through the beginning of the recession, UCI did obviously witness enormous growth. Buildings sprouted up all around the campus. There was even a new hospital built. Unbelievable. Enormously expensive. Existing academic programs, particularly those in the most expensive areas of laboratory science, dramatically increased in size. New expensive programs, including a school of law and a college of health science, were launched. To take one simple measure, over the eight-year period from fall 2000 until fall 2008, the filled line faculty positions, that is to say full professors, associate professors, and assistant professors on the general campus grew by 41%. 41% growth. Surely the most publicized development during this period was the creation of the School of Law. We're all aware not only of the aspirations associated with the creation of the first new public law school in California in almost 35 years, but also with the extraordinary quality of the new dean and his early successes in recruiting new faculty and students. So let's make it crystal clear. Among the ways that this might have worked, this has worked really well. Okay. Now that we've patted ourselves on the back, there are some other features which have not been emphasized by the university. First, the School of Law was created during a time of affluence for the UC system, and the campus administration indicated that it would not need extra state funds to create and run the school. Rather, operational costs were to be covered through, quote, student fee revenue, state enrollment growth funding, and private donations. Now, of course, there's no enrollment growth funding, and private donations have dwindled to a trickle. Moreover, of the $28 million at the launch of the school, approximately 80% came from Donald Bren, who since then has distanced himself both from the school and from the campus, surely in part because of the way in which the new dean was selected. Just as an indicator of Bren's distancing, his stepmother, Claire Trevor, for whom he gave money to name the School of the Arts, they had an important ceremony 10 years after, placing a star in the School of the Arts to honor her, and he didn't even come. That's how happy he's been. If you notice, Bren doesn't give money to UCI anymore. So, I mean, one of the consequences of the law school was clearly the major benefactor of UCI isn't benefacting us anymore, to coin a term. Now, but there's more than that involved. In December of 2009, the legislative analyst prepared a report on the master plan at 50. It singled out the UCI School of Law for special attention and stated, "The establishment of this is a quote, the establishment of the UC Irvine School of Law raises concerns in our view because one, CPEC, that is the California Post Educational Commission, which is supposed to approve all new programs, did not concur with the proposal. Incidentally, they did not concur with the proposal because they felt we didn't need more lawyers. And interestingly enough, this year, the law school at Hastings has reduced the number of students it's admitted by 20% because there is such a glut of lawyers on the market they can't be placed." That's parenthetical. First, CPEC did not concur with the proposal, and second, the UC Regents established the school despite CPEC's objections. "Both of these decisions are rare," said the legislative analysis. "The University of California was unable to identify another instance in which the system had moved ahead with a proposal without CPEC's concurrence." Now, as the California legislature thinks about future funding for the UC system, and in particular for the Irvine campus, I would think that this precedent would be extremely costly for us. Arrogance may very well be an appealing characteristic for the person exercising it, but rarely is it attractive to the audience which is a recipient of it. And it's odd for a public university to be arrogant vis-a-vis its primary funding sources. That's not on a priori grounds an intelligent stance. Third, what happened during this period with our relative status? It's a very important indicator because we had enormous growth. Now, I want to look at general rankings. In the 1990s, U.S. News and World Report had ranked us as high as 36th in 1999 in the nation amongst public and private universities. Moreover, in the 1990s, UCI was typically better ranked than Davis and Santa Barbara. More recently, our position has fallen to the mid and late 40s, and typically after Davis and Santa Barbara. Now, it's extremely difficult for us to argue that this decline is because the UC system isn't that well funded, since the funding in the UC system includes both Davis and Santa Barbara, as well as Irvine. But this is not only the case vis-a-vis U.S. News and World Report. It holds for all rankings. If we look at the National Research Council rankings for graduate programs, and not necessarily use the local rhetoric which was devised and presented to analyze those rankings, but look at what the Office of the President did. Presumably the Office of the President somehow picks up some indicator that it can apply fairly to all of the UC campuses. It stated in its release that 141 UC programs were ranked amongst the top 10 in their field. So I collected information as to how they calculated this and recalculated for the key growth campuses what was happening, since they didn't break it down campus by campus. And what I discovered was the following. On the measure the UC President's office used, Davis had 14 top 10 ranked departments. San Diego and Santa Barbara each had 13 such departments. Santa Cruz had 4. Irvine had 2. And Riverside had 0. Another indicator pointing in exactly the same direction as the U.S. News and World Report indicator. Finally, to take a recent example which both exemplifies how we talk about ourselves and the reality masked by that publicity, is the recent rankings by the Times of London Higher Education. The UCI website indicates, quite appropriately, that UCI is fourth on the list of universities less than 50 years old. The UCI Law School website takes that a first step further and says, we're number one among new universities in the United States. Congratulations. Be proud of ourselves. Wonderful. Now, the Times doesn't do a separate ranking for new universities. It does a global ranking of all universities, new and old. When we look at that global ranking, what we see is that in the 2010 rankings, UCI was listed as 49th in the world, ahead of Davis and behind Santa Barbara. In the current complete list, where we're number 4. But in the complete list, we've fallen to 86th in the world, while Santa Barbara's risen to 35th and Davis to 38th. Again, all of the indicators always pointing in the same direction. Simply put, during the last growth spurt on the campus, in spite of the rhetoric to the contrary, we did not capitalize fully on the opportunities which were presented to us. In fact, a strong argument could be made that we failed to maintain the momentum that we had developed in earlier phases of growth while seemingly taking special steps, going out of our way to antagonize the legislature that funds us and wealthy donors who had been generous to us. Again, that's just looking at the facts. Now, the final set of observations I'd like to make is, what does the future look like? Obviously, no one has a crystal ball, but I think there are some likely developments to take place over UCI's future history. And I'd like to consider these, in particularly the following features: the idea of the one university, the idea as to how we're going to replace funds, including the consideration of the expanding number of out-of-state and foreign students, and our endowments. So, the idea of a single university, of one university. In 1932, at the time of founding of UCLA, President Robert Sproul voiced the idea of the one university, that the University of California is a single institution whose campuses are united in the pursuit of a common mission and common standards of quality. We at Irvine have always drawn on the one university idea. We've always linked ourselves with other UC campuses, and we've always perceived of that as central to our capacity to have grown and developed as a university. This one university idea is currently under greater assault than it's ever been in the history of the University of California. And under the impetus of the budget crisis, I can't possibly imagine how it's going to survive. The one university idea, first of all, is unique to the state of California. It's not the typical way public university systems run. And President Udall is used to the typical way, and that typical way includes a flagship campus treated differently than the rest. Moreover, given the level of budget crisis we're currently facing, any president, not just a mediocre one, any board of regents, no matter who they were, would have as their first priority the maintenance of Berkeley. Berkeley is a jewel of American higher education, of world higher education, and its future is threatened. Maybe even UCLA is a jewel. If it is, it's surely less of a jewel, but it's pretty close to being a jewel. And if you can't maintain everything, you don't let everything slide. So, the first thing is, this one university idea, which has been so valuable to us, I think is in basically an endangered species, if not already dead. Now, there are also proposals for differential tuition, as well as proposals to dramatically increase the number of foreign and out-of-state students. This clearly, again, undermines the one university. Let's be honest. You're going to high school on Long Island. California's got a nice climate. You look, you think, you want to go to school. You're really smart. You can go to Harvard. You can go to Princeton. You can go to Yale. You can even go to Columbia. You've got to choose where you're going to go to. And you think, maybe I should go out west. Well, you might think of Berkeley. I don't think you're going to think of UCI, at least if you're that category of student. That, again, is the way it is. So, and that leads in turn to the fact that a Berkeley BA is worth more than a Santa Cruz BA. Now, the quality of those out-of-state and foreign students willing to pay full tuition at Berkeley is also going to be much higher than those willing to pay full tuition at Riverside. That leads to the second consideration, the key idea for dealing with the budget crisis is to replace state funds with student tuition funds. Already today, for the first time in the University of California's history, more of our revenues are coming from student tuition than from legislative allocations. More is coming from student tuition than from legislative allocations. The idea is normally talked about as becoming privatized. However, there are certain obvious issues not being discussed. The governor has suggested that depending upon the upcoming budgetary situation for the state, UC tuition could rise to as high as $20,000 or $25,000 for the whole year. Are students going to accept this kind of tuition growth with absolute quiescence? I don't know, but it's certainly plausible that they might be asking questions like, what am I getting for my money? Now, those of you who are talking to colleagues know clearly that we've dramatically increased what we're charging students. We are not giving them anything more. In fact, we're giving them less. We are charging more and providing less. I see nowhere on campus faculty saying, gee, if students are paying so much more, I've got to teach an extra class. I've got to extend my office hours. Quite to the contrary, faculty are saying, you're treating us so badly, I can't keep on doing all that I'm doing. I've got to do less, not more. So these two poles are going in absolutely opposite direction. Now, what's going to happen? Will the governor and the legislature maintain the level of University of California budgeting, assuming that the new proposals for increased taxes don't pass? And if you really think those proposals are going to pass, you're living in a much happier world than I'm living in. The taxpayers of the state of California are not going to vote to tax themselves more to help us. Because on top of everything else, they perceive us as being arrogant. Not only by things like the law school, but it was relatively recently that about 36 of our top executives publicly sought greater retirement benefits than those currently afforded by the university, which limited them to a paltry $245,000 per annum. In the midst of the budget cut, 36 of our highly paid people made a public protest, and the university dealt with that not by firing all of them, which might have had some positive public view, but I say, no, we're not going to raise your retirements anymore. You know, is that outrageous, Ron? If you think about it, you're getting $800,000, and then you're going to retire and be cut down to $245,000. This is ridiculous. How dare we treat these wonderful people this way just because they can't get jobs anywhere else? And how does the state, how does the taxpayer look at that? Not with the kind of benevolence that we look at it. Oh, well, you know, we've got to pay people a lot of money to run our hospital. There's a market. A market, there are two kinds of markets, a real market and an abstract market. I fully believe we should compete with real markets. Abstract markets are a whole different ballgame. It's what hypothetically you could get if someone else wanted you. You know, we've had a series of administrators on this campus who came here precisely to leave. Executive Vice Chancellor Tian was able to do that. A number of subsequent executive vice chancellors never went anywhere. And I don't think it's because they fell in love with Irvine. And that's the reality. Again, we've had chancellors who've come to go. We've even had chancellors who came to retire and went. I mean, Felderson came to retire and he still left. Other chancellors came to go and no one wanted them. Those are abstract markets. You cannot deal with an abstract market, only with a concrete market. And how do other people hear about us as a public university with these sorts of numbers? So, the university, in this context, has reduced its commitment to undergraduate education while increasing tuition. It's reduced that commitment in a number of ways. By the types of faculty it's hired. So, for instance, all that law school growth contributes nothing to undergraduate education. The amount of contribution that's made in laboratory sciences is much less than in non-laboratory sciences. So, again, interestingly enough, and putting a bit, if you wish, the realities of the budgetary crisis as we felt it with the monies that we've saved in the context, in the year 2000, well, we're doing pretty well. Okay. If you divide the number of filled faculty positions on campus into our total enrollments, undergraduate and graduate, you have 30.1 students per FTE, 30.1. What is it in 2011? 29.1. In other words, in terms of filled FTE, we're doing better. The problem is where they're distributed and what our expectations are as to what people are supposed to do. Now, the other thing we've tried to do is recruit out-of-state and foreign students in order to grow revenue. Now, in the 2011 and 12 academic year, the fees for an out-of-state student are $22,878 more than for an in-state student. That's about $23,000 per head. Incidentally, the university, in another act of intelligence worthy of someone not bright enough to teach kindergarten, calls these people net payers. We have documents that refer to the growth of net payers, not foreign students, out-of-state students. We do that, but net payers is our preferred term. Why? Because that's why we want them. We're going to suck that money out of them, just like gas out of the tank. Now, for the upcoming fall, UCI is going to enroll 541 out-of-state and foreign freshmen, as compared to 214 last year, more than doubling. And the year before, it was 114. So we've been doubling every year the number of our net payers. That's a dramatic increase which will provide the UCI campus with $7.5 million more. Assuming that none of those students receive scholarships or financial aid. This is a tremendous amount of money, unless, of course, you consider that simply if Governor Brown's proposed measures for increasing state revenue, that is to say the tax increases, that simply if those are not adopted in November, state support to UCI will be reduced by $25 million. So we lose 25 and we gain 7. No matter how you cut the cake, that's not working well. Now, while Berkeley should, I believe, be able to attract students of the highest caliber from out of state and from abroad, this is not true for UCI. In fact, of those we admitted, and I'm extrapolating a bit from the data, but I think it's a legitimate extrapolation. In 2010, of those we admitted, 9.2% enrolled at UCI. But in 2012, the percentage has grown to 15.5%. And one of the reasons you enroll in UCI is it's your best alternative. Now, if you're increasing by more than 50%, the numbers that are enrolling, it may be that you're dipping a bit lower into the pile. Further evidence of that is that this year, in terms of the undergraduates that we admit, our admissions for undergraduates works in the following way. The admissions office sits down, they look through all the applications, they choose those we're going to admit. There are substantially more than actually come. And then we have wait lists. To my knowledge, we've never gone through wait lists. This year, we were 500 students short. So in terms of what we wanted to get, we were 500 off target. To get those 500, we had to not only go through all of our wait lists, but we also had to look at the undergraduate students who we had rejected and who they protested and said, "Why did you reject me?" Well, they didn't actually say, "Why did you reject me?" "Why you reject me?" Because they didn't write that well. And those are what we call the appeals. And we were accepting our appeals to get up to that 500, so we got our right number. Very problematic. Finally, let us not forget that major private universities, tuition as high as it may be, only pays part of the cost of undergraduates. The rest comes from a multitude of sources, including major endowments, largely given by long dead generations of former students who give precisely because they had what they regarded as a wonderful undergraduate experience. For UCI to develop such monies will take many decades. Not only that, it will also take a fundamental reorientation of the faculty and of the administration, such that your typical undergraduate says that they are having an experience here which has shaped and has made them. The majority of our undergraduates have a feeling of passing through. So we would have to change that experience through a greater devotion to undergraduate education. But just to provide an idea of how far behind we are, and I've chosen a ridiculous comparison. The per student endowment at Princeton University is $1.9 million per student. $1.9 million per student. The endowment at UCI is $8,600 per student. The level of difference, the chasm, is incomprehensible. But if you take other indicators of difference, for example, membership in the National Academy of Sciences, the ratio is something like 1 to 3, 1 to 4. Here the ratio is in the hundreds and in the thousands. So it provides a sense as to how far we can go. So to conclude, I want to argue that UCI's future and the future of the entire University of California is threatened. The challenges are enormous and the currently proposed remedies are inadequate. Currently, this university system is an enormous source of pride and accomplishment. The legacy is unlikely to be maintained unless the state redevelops its commitment to the UC system, or unless we come up with new and different ideas. We cannot take those new directions by maintaining a policy in which the members of the university community play no role in thinking about and trying to figure out how do we deal with the realities confronting us. And that's been the central problem for none of these things being talked about. I'd love to take questions. I mean, I'm sorry. I really, you know, everybody here cares about the university. Most of us have spent our life here. It matters a lot to us. It's the closest thing we've got to a second family. And we don't talk about these things. It's extraordinary. Now, this has been a very, very superficial overlay, but I've tried to lay out some of the concerns. I don't know if anybody wants to say anything.
Rob? Besides learning to talk about the problem in more realistic terms, rather than simply patting ourselves on the
back, yeah.
What is it that you believe the faculty, the emeriti,
yeah,
the alumni can and should do?
I believe UCI started to make a series of major mistakes when we began recruiting administrators who we perceived of as being professionally gifted, but with no linkage to the campus. And the results are the way in which such people think about their behavior is to advance their own career. They don't think about it, that they're coming to some place. And their future, they're not part of the community. I think one of the things that we could do, and in fact that the budget crisis improves the likelihood of us doing, is insisting that our administrators, except in exceptional circumstances, come from amongst us. The other thing, oddly, we need is a much less quiescent faculty. The faculty has become unbelievably quiescent. Anything goes. Moreover, when the faculty is angry about things, it's never our own people. We have become extraordinarily deferential towards our administrators. We sit in the privacy of our office and we say, Hickenlooper is an idiot. And then we see Hickenlooper and we say, oh, you're so smart. You're so intelligent. I love you so much. We're so lucky to have you. We began that outspoken faculty, and a faculty that's realistic. The realities are the following. If you look at the public opinion polling in the state of California, a surprisingly small percentage of the population, this is adding on to your question mark, a surprisingly small percentage of the population thinks well of the University of California and thinks that we're doing our job well. What has our response been to that? To say, you're wrong, we're wonderful. You know, I can stand up here from now to doomsday and tell you that I'm better looking than George Clooney. But that's not going to change your vision of me. Okay. So now, are there things that the faculty, emeriti, regular, the administration could do? You better believe it. The emeriti, for example, is an enormous group of people who have enormous experience in the university, most of whom have enormous commitment, who could be mobilized on behalf of the institute. No one wants that. You all know that. You sit in trepidation that they'll pull your office from you. We're not being mobilized either. Our emeriti faculty, our emeriti staff, mind you, I haven't talked about the staff. Why haven't I talked about the staff? Not because it doesn't matter, but because the university, to deal with the budget crisis, what it did is it froze salary of staff, and staff salaries account for about 15% of our total budget, but it didn't for faculty, which account for around 65% of our total budget. Do you realize the wisdom of that? I mean, it's insane. You know, we're going to deal with the budget crisis by ordering fewer rubber bands. So there are a number of things, but part of the answer is for people to believe that we are embedded in the solution to that problem, to have the intelligence that simply asserting what wonderful things we're doing isn't good enough. So I think that, you know, engagement could help. I'm not optimistic, incidentally, of any of those things happening. I think that for too prolonged a period of time, we've had too much hierarchy between a professional administrative management team, that faculty and staff have become very deferential toward. Mind you, staff have more reason to be deferential. They can actually lose their job. I mean, what can they do to a faculty member? Very little. But that little we find so bothersome that we draw into our shell.
Thanks for your very impressive and depressing talk, Marie. I wonder if you could say a few words about your perception of President Rudolph's leadership.
Well, Professor... President Rudolph, who, as we all know, in one of his earliest interviews, compared the faculty to a cemetery.
That's part of what I had in mind.
He also, my actual favorite comment in an early interview, when the furloughs were there, and he's asked, what's the difference between a furlough and a reduction in salary? And he says, the president of the University of California, publicly, to a journalist, and a smart guy, a guy with lots of experience, says, look, I grew up in a working class family, and we didn't sit around the dining room table talking about the meaning of words.
This from a professor of law.
Well, that's part of it. Okay. Now, mind you, before we had UDOP, we had Dines. I mean, so the fact of the matter is we had from within our own midst picked up someone who, again, had no identification with the system. Dines had grown up in the Bell Labs. He was brought into San Diego as a high-level administrator and then continued to be. UDOF effectively was brought in, I think, with a mission, and a mission to change the way the UC system works, and he's doing that. Are we going to get to do anything about that? No, we're not. Bingo. But mind you, we don't do very much about anything more locally, which is under our control. Do I think he's doing a good job? Of course not. Do I think he's moving us in the right direction? I have to be honest with you. Put yourself in that position over there. The money's shrinking. Are you going to run the risk of converting Berkeley to a second-class institution so you can maintain Santa Cruz, Riverside, and Irvine? I'm not sure that any of us forced with that challenge objectively would make a different decision. That's why the problem has to... That's not the solution to the problem. That's not going to change up there, in my opinion.
Other states recruiting California students, giving them money.
Sure.
And I'm wondering about what the impact, I mean, really, really strongly recruiting them, saying California's winning with money, we'll give you a better education, it will cost you a lot less.
And we'll get you out in 4 years.
And we'll get you out in 4 years.
I think one of the things which we're running into a big risk is, now again, going back 10, 15 years ago, I always taught undergraduates. I mean, even during the 20 years I served as dean, I taught big undergraduate courses. So I have a lot of experience with our undergraduates. Let me be honest with you. Rarely have I found them intimidating as a collectivity. One of our challenges is to build the qualities of our undergraduate student body. It's always been very mixed. So we have some who are absolutely superb, as good as you could find anywhere, and some probably who are as bad as you could find anywhere. The problem that you identify is that it's as good as anywhere are going to shrink, if not totally disappear. So that, again, one of the things that we've not talked about is how do we do something about that? Let's take a for instance. Someone said about what a maritime might do. Imagine the university was seriously concerned about recruiting top quality undergraduates. Well, one of the things we might do as a general policy is, after all of the emeriti have comfortable retirements, not at the $245,000 level, but still they're doing okay. I mean, they're not coming here, you know, to rummaging through the garbage pails. We might do a couple of things. We might try to get everybody to do at least some teaching, and we might, at modest compensation, and we might ask them to go out to, under a coordinated policy, to various high schools to talk to high school students about what UCI is like. They probably, on the whole, I mean, not everyone's like Duncan, you know, who is producing, you know, like a young stir hoping that he's going to get tenure at the most distinguished of departments. But even Duncan could spare a little time to go somewhere to talk to people about, why don't you come to UCI? Why this might be a good environment. So to get back to Ron saying, here you have an enormous group of people, incidentally, not just the faculty, but also the staff, who have the identification, the experience, the knowledge of how things work. Okay. Is this being done? No. Would this cost anything? No. 58 FTE this year. This year, 58. Basically, every year in the crisis, we're recruiting on the average 50. So much so that our faculty sigh. We explained that students aren't getting, you know, we haven't been able to keep up with faculty growth. The reality is the faculty-student ratio during the recession period has not declined. So there's no reason for the education not to be better, if that were the only factor at play. So there are things, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, nowadays, given the differential level even that major privates have for tuition support, so that what we run the risk of losing is our very best. And if you chop off the very best from what we have, that's a real serious problem.
I had this perception earlier that the population at large looked at undergraduate education at the university system as being only for the strenuous student, because the discussion sessions quite often were led by foreign students who needed the money, but whose language skills were not up to making themselves intelligent, and that therefore the better thing to do was to go to Cal State or to a junior college for the first 2 years and sort of toughen up your academic skills so that you would be able to cope with what they would find at the university. So it's hard to build, if that indeed is still the reigning perception, it's hard to build enthusiasm for undergraduate education.
I think probably that is the reigning perception. I mean, you know, when the university publicly proclaimed that UCI meant under construction indefinitely, the exterior community referred to UCI as the University of Chinese Immigrants. So there, you're tapping, I think, an important feature. Mind you, before I answer your question, which is getting worse, and let me tell you why. Those foreign students that we are recruiting, those foreign students that we're recruiting are not distributed around the globe. They're overwhelmingly coming from Southeast Asia. So what happens is two things. Not only do we increase the number of people whose fluency in English is limited, but we increase the perception that that's all we have. Because when you stand next to each other, a kid who did his high school in Beijing and a kid who did his high school in Garden Grove, both of whom are of Chinese ancestry, you don't see that one is a native language speaker while the other isn't. So that is a very, very substantial problem for UCI. Again, some of those things I think can work in a host of different ways to be improved. One of them is that academic units Again, an administration can say, we really want the students running sections to be able to speak English. They don't have to be intelligent. I mean, we can't be that demanding. But we could insist that they be able to speak English fluently. Now, mind you, there are some people who speak English, an accent in English, but very fluently. Okay, and no one's going to object to having Henry Kissinger as their section leader. Okay, we're not talking about that. So it's not accent, it's not the point. Could we enforce that? Of course we could. Why might we enforce that? Because we care about undergraduates. Would that make the headlines? Yes, it would. Might that change perceptions? Of course it could. Will we do that? Not with an administration that doesn't want to stir the pot. That would be discriminatory. Why do people have to speak English in a classroom?
How can that perception, the administration's perception, how can...
Well, first of all, part of the problem is the administration has no contact in the classroom. One of the things that our chancellors and executive vice chancellors don't do is teach. They every once in a while, to get some publicity, they do a freshman seminar, which they co-teach with someone else, which meets for 1 hour a week. It is not a course. I mean, you know, even the people in the medical school would be willing to do that. It's so non-demanding. That's how non-demanding it is. Excuse me, Ted, but it's true. Okay. You know, the people in the medical school look at microbes and undergraduates in the same category. You got to stay away from them. So, I'll give you an anecdote. It's not that way everywhere. I've told to more than one chancellor the following anecdote. When Rudenstine was appointed president of Harvard University, and before he began serving, and this was around 95 or 96, there was an interview in the spring issue of the Harvard magazine, which probably either Frank or Duncan lent me, because they are Harvardian. And the interview, maybe Ellen did, the interview asked thus, about to begin president of Harvard University. Mind you, Harvard is a research university. I mean, it's not sort of a teaching college. What you're about to start as president, what is your top priority? And Rubenstein answered in the Harvard magazine. He says, well, the first thing that I want to do is I've submitted a syllabus and a request to the English department to get permission to teach an upper division course on Shakespeare. And I'm hoping that they approve that. Okay. Now, I've given this example to a succession of chancellors, suggesting that this might be a way of emulating Harvard. None has wanted to follow that road. Now, it's a very interesting difference, and it is a difference that in part, is related not just to the individual's vision of what his role is in this larger institution as a member of the community, it's certainly related, but it's also quite pragmatic. If you want the alumni to give, who are the alumni, the former students? So the fact that I want to get into the classroom, that's a sign, gee, this is a great university.
When I was on a university-wide committee, we had a liaison from the OP. Usually sort of saying those sacred words. And I remember him telling me, and a very bright guy, that the office of the president had at least 110 people in it. I've been told that it's been somewhat reduced. I don't know. What I'm going to ask you is, suppose these separate universities, the universities in the UC system, went their own way and became independent. Then we would be confronted with a challenge to make ends meet and to look at ourselves without having 110 people supervising us and providing a roadblock. And so that would actually require or demand more participation by the faculty. The usual objection that I've heard is from other states,
yeah,
different campuses fight each other for money.
Yeah.
But that would be another challenge that would require a response. So, Trying these little paradigm might actually work. What do you think?
Well, I have a couple of... First of all, one good thing to say about Udall, he's reduced that bureaucracy substantially. One of the things that everyone reports is the Office of the President bureaucracy has really been cut down. If we went our own way, which we might end up doing, I think it's not absolutely clear of the faculty playing a more central role. I think that one of the biggest advantages that Irvine has is it's located in the midst of an extremely wealthy community. And a community that is not just wealthy, but is committed to higher education. So the first thing we get is we get a board of trustees that would be drawn from the surrounding Orange County business community. Now the interesting feature there is the disjunction between the political views of the university faculty as a whole and the political views of the wealthy members of the Orange County business community. They are very, very distinct. And what might come from that is a very tough call. Remember, private universities, as they're whipping together their board of trustees, are drawing on alumni who, regardless of their political views, remember when they were 22 years old and they took your course on Roman law and that shaped their life. And they, you know, they've never been the same. That's not necessarily a view that Henry Samueli and Donald Brenn, etc., might have. So their views might be of a different order. And given the extent to which the Board of Trustees is a wealth-generating entity, I don't know how that would play out. So I'm certain we may find out if we live long enough.
I'm wondering how you find the foreign students coming in. Are they... I'm sure they're very bright, but probably
I don't know why you would be sure of that.
Oh, well, okay.
I'm not at all sure that they're very bright. I think that they're predominantly foreign students who can't get in elsewhere.
Well, how are their English skills?
Their English skills and their intellectual skills are at a par. I was trying to be cute and no one picked it up. I mean, they don't speak well and they don't think well, but other than that, they're wonderful.
Okay.
I mean, we are not the foreign students. I mean, first of all, American private universities have a long and distinguished history of bringing in absolutely first-class foreign students. Let's begin with the fact that most people in the UK want to go to the university in the UK. Most people in China want to go to the university in China. Amongst those who are willing to test new waters, especially as an undergraduate, first and foremost, you have a very small number who are really gifted. The private universities have well-established lines of recruitment, so they bring in those people, and they bring them in with great success. As we walk into that terrain, what we're selling is an American education, but we're selling an American education not of an elite order. And so we're not attracting anything close to the best and the brightest. On the whole, I think it will be fair to say that our foreign students are less good than our California resident students. And remember the way I described our California resident students. So whatever, and no one can provide data, real data, that could show the contrary of that. They can prop their lips. I mean, a former chancellor came up with the measure of institutional quality, the number of people who applied to your BA programs, and said Irvine was in the top 10 in the country. Okay. Now let me help you understand why that's the case. Shortly before he came up with that measure, the University of California came up with a unified undergraduate application. What that meant was